For the past 15 years, this man, Tom Cruise, has been attempting to discredit the Impossible Mission Force through a series of films. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to expose these films as counter-propaganda and disinformation. As usual, if you or any of your Corps team are discovered or captured, it will be a miracle, as it means you finally have listeners. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Hello, and welcome to TwerpCast episode 58. I am FCast. Today we will be discussing all things Mission Impossible. I'd like to introduce you to executive producer James Caswell and Tom Cruise's biggest fan.
And that's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions and my second favorite Jew right behind Stephen Hill.
As you gathered from our introduction, today we're discussing Mission Impossible. The year 2011 brings us a new movie, but we're going to start out talking a little bit about the original series, produced and created by Bruce Geller.
Mission Impossible ran from 1966 to 1973 on CBS. It followed a special group of spies who fought dictators, evil organizations, and crime lords. The team was originally led by Dan Briggs, played by Stephen Hill, who left after the first season due to his religious beliefs. At the time, he had it in his contract that as of sundown Friday evening, he was done working so that he could honor the Sabbath. And while they had no problem with this in concept, in follow-through, it actually tended to cause difficulties with production, and therefore both he and the company agreed that he would only do one season.
In season two, Stephen Hill was replaced by Peter Graves, taking on the role of Jim Phelps.
For anyone who knows anything about the Mission Impossible TV series, Jim Phelps is, by and large, the most recognized leader of the IMF team. If you've never heard of the name Jim Phelps, or if the only reference that you have to a leader of the Mission Impossible team is Ethan Hunt, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes, you deserve better.
Other popular members of the first team were Cinnamon Carter, who was played by Barbara Bain.
Barney Collier, played by Greg Morris.
Roland Hand, played by Martin Landau.
And Willie Armitage, played by Peter Lupus.
Now, 1966 to 1973 was a fairly long run. Back then, 7 seasons was a significant amount of time, especially when you have actual movie stars like Martin Landau as part of your cast. In fact, the entire first season, Martin Landau was only billed as a special guest because his contract left an opening that at any point in time, if he was offered a movie role, he could leave the show. When season 2 rolled around, he went on ahead and just signed up as a full member of the cast. He was a regular on the show for seasons 2 and 3, but then in season 4, he left to go do movies again, and his character of Roland Hand was replaced by the great Paris, who was played by
Leonard Nimoy, having fairly recently been released from Star Trek.
Landau wasn't the only one who left. Barbara Bain was replaced by Leslie Ann Warren, who was a fairly new name at the time, and she played Dana Lambert. She was on the show for season 5. Then Linda Day George came in as Lisa Casey in season 6. And when George had to go on maternity leave for season 7, she was replaced by Barbara Anderson, who played Mimi Davis.
The show started out with an international flavor, but became more of an American crime drama after season 5.
Yeah, keep in mind that 1966, movies like James Bond were really hitting their stride. So the idea of a group of international spies was going to be a popular concept. They were able to use that concept for 4 whole seasons. It wasn't until Bruce Lansbury came in and said, you know what, things are kind of difficult on the world scale because of the Cold War and things like that. And a lot of the times they would make vague references to the Cold War, but they didn't want to talk about it directly because back then the Cold War was something that you didn't talk about all the time. It was something that a lot of people were afraid of, the whole duck and cover thing. It wasn't like things are today where war is constantly plastered on the TV. It was a completely different type of warfare. So when Lansbury came in, he decided that he wanted to tell more crime dramas, keep them in the United States more.
I'm sure that most of the people listening are familiar with the show's formula format.
Yeah, every show started out the same way. You had the tape scene, where he would get the tape, play the tape, there'd be the classic, this tape will self-destruct in 30 seconds, and then the tape would self-destruct. You'd have the dossier scene, where he would flip through the various agents and decide who was the best operatives for what he needed to do.
One of my favorite parts of the show, you see in every episode, okay, these are the main characters and the special guest star.
Who isn't playing the bad guy?
Correct.
You'd have the apartment meeting scene where they would all get together and talk about what the case was going to be and how they wanted to go about it. And then you'd have the plan, them going on out and actually doing the job. So, as we said, the show had a good run. 7 years was a good run then. It's a great run now. You don't get a lot of shows that stay on the air for 7 years. But as many shows, it was eventually canceled, and it seemed like it was done. Then, in 1988, Hollywood had writer's strike.
Yes, but that did not keep television producers from wanting to increase their pocketbook.
Yeah, in spite of the fact that the writers were refusing to write, the producers still needed to have stuff to produce. So what a few of them did was they came up with the idea of, let's go back into the archives, see what we have available, and we'll figure out a way to make it work. Thus was born Mission Impossible 1988.
They took episodes from the original series and reworked them in-house with new characters.
Originally, the idea was they were just going to do a reboot. Of course, this was back before the idea of doing reboots of shows was even thought of or anything like that. This was back when Hollywood actually tried to come up with new and original ideas. The fools. But when they were actually able to sign Peter Graves to come back and play Jim Phelps again, they decided, no, we'll make this the next generation. We'll have Jim Phelps coming out of retirement and working with a whole new team. The other little casting coup was getting Phil Morris to play the Collier character, because his father, Greg, played Barney Collier in the original series. They took and named the character Grant and made him Barney's son.
Actress Jane Badler of V fame came on to play the character Shannon Reed in the second season.
But for the most part, a lot of the characters really were kind of carbon copies of the originals. You had Nicholas Black, who was a master of disguise and sleight of hand, just like Roland Hand was. You had Max Hart, who was the big strong athlete that was the brawn of the team, just like Willie was. You had Casey Randall, and then in season 2, Shannon Reed, who were the pretty actress model type characters that were able to use their feminine wiles on the bad guys. And of course, Collier was Brains, the science guy.
Well, the show didn't have the appeal of the original series.
And honestly, it did what it needed to do. They were looking for something to fill the slot during the writer's strike, and it did what they had intended it to do. If anything, I would actually call this show a success, because it managed to stay on a whole nother season after the writer's strike was over. It took them bouncing it from time slot to time slot to time slot to actually get it killed off.
But after 2 seasons, it looked like that was the end of Mission Impossible.
Wrong again. In 1996, Tom Cruise got his mitts on the franchise and decided to make feature films out of it. Now, before we go into any depth and detail about the movies, I want to put out a couple of disclaimers. I'm not the hugest fan of the film series, and there are a few key elements that explain why I'm not a huge fan. First and foremost, the IMF was an ensemble. It was a group of people working together to get the case taken care of on the TV show. But the films are primarily a vehicle for Tom Cruise to star. Add on to that the fact that I've always kind of had a problem with Tom Cruise as an action star. I grew up with action stars like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone and Bruce Willis. Real men's men kind of guys.
Oh, from what I hear, Cruise is a man's man.
Tom Cruise is a little bit effeminate. I'm not saying he's gay, although there are a lot of people out there who do, but he is kind of effeminate. He does a great job of playing a romantic comedy lead. He does a good job of playing a dramatic lead, but I've always had trouble with him in the action star lead. The fact that I've heard that in most scenes, he actually has to stand on a box to look in his leading lady's eyes might have something to do with it, too.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say is you're not really a Cruise fan. I've always enjoyed Tom Cruise.
There have been some Tom Cruise movies that I've enjoyed. I liked Jerry Maguire. I liked Top Gun, which, in talking about not really respecting him as an action star, some people would say that Top Gun was an action movie, but that was a fighter jet movie. It wasn't, I'm going to go running down the street shooting off guns or riding a motorcycle or things like that. He was sitting in a cockpit. It's easy to look manly sitting in a cockpit.
You say cockpit.
Thank you, Beavis. I liked Risky Business. But if you notice, two of those three movies were those romantic comedies. Like I said, he does a decent job in that. Not so much as the action star for me.
I've never had the problem with Cruise that you have. I like him as a movie star. I think he's a little bit nuts as a human being. I don't care what his sexuality is. As long as the movie's good, who he falls in love with is his business. But I think as a person, he comes off as a whack job.
The other problem that I always had with the movies was that the TV series was all about being secretive. Their job was to go on in, sabotage the bad guy, kind of make the bad guy foil themselves, and then get out again. The movies are all about the big bang. Gotta have the big explosions, gotta have the gunfights, gotta have the car chases, and it's an action movie, I get that. It's needed. But it has a different feel from the TV show, and the idea of this Black Ops group going on in and blowing everything to smithereens, it kind of goes against that whole concept of Black Ops.
You know, this is a slight derailment, but I think you've hit upon why I like the show Burn Notice. The show Burn Notice really follows the format of Mission Impossible. Get the bad guys to out themselves.
Yeah, and honestly, it takes a lot more thought and planning and care to completely stay off the radar than to go on in with guns blazing and things exploding.
Oh, Fiona likes guns blazing and things exploding, but yet the format of Burn Notice still works.
She's a very usable character when you need the big explosions, and you need the gun battles, and you need the car chases. That is what her character is for. But for the most part, Michael Weston is the IMF agent. He's the guy who stops, and he thinks it out, he makes a plan, and his main goal isn't to slap cuffs on the guy. His main goal is to make the guy mess up so that other people can slap the cuffs on him. So yes, I completely agree. Burn Notice is right in that format, almost to the point where the only thing that's missing is the dossier scene.
Yes, and they actually, although there's no dossier, they have enough regular characters, but that's a little bit of a train derailment there. We're talking Mission Impossible. So, in 1996, Tom Cruise enlists Brian De Palma to direct the first movie called Mission Impossible.
Tom Cruise played Ethan Hunt, and the primary idea behind the story was that Ethan Hunt was taking over the IMF to undercover a mole in the CIA. The movie also starred one of my favorite actors at the time, which was Ving Rhames, and he played Luther Stickle. Ving Rhames is a very large man, big, burly, and him playing the computer expert was just humorous on multiple levels.
Yes, it also has a brief cameo by Emilio Estevez.
But in my book, the first Mission Impossible movie is by far the worst Mission Impossible movie, and it's purely a story point.
I can't agree with you more. I disavow this film completely. I consider myself a completist when it comes to my DVD collection, and I refuse to add Mission Impossible. I have 2 and 3, but I will not put Mission Impossible 1 in my collection because I hated this story point so much.
Spoiler alert, but please pay attention to the spoiler alert so you don't have to go and see Mission Impossible, the film. They have John Voight playing Jim Phelps. Jim Phelps turns out to be the bad guy. The idea of taking the leader of the IMF and turning him into the bad guy of the film was insulting. It was insulting to Peter Graves. It was insulting to both previous versions of the TV series. It was insulting to the fans.
And it was a huge slap in the face to Bruce Geller. Bruce Geller was not asked to consult on this movie. He was not asked for his input on the story. Bruce Geller was essentially completely excluded from this.
And I may be reading too much into it, but it really felt like a huge Tom Cruise ego thing. I not only have to be the star of the movie, I not only have to be the leader of the IMF team, but I have to completely destroy the previous versions of IMF. And I fully realize I might be reading too much into it, but that's how it came across to me.
The nicest thing I had to say about this movie is it had a couple of cool stunts in it.
The Tom Cruise descending on the swing wires into the pressure-plated room, I think we can honestly call that a groundbreaking scene, because we've had so many people who have replicated it over the years.
So that being said, we're giving it 0 pens in the pocket protector, 2 thumbs down.
Now keep in mind that 0 pens in the pen protector is after we've put a few pens back in because we respected some of the stunts. Otherwise, it would be negative pens in the pen protector.
However, for those who are a Twitter with wonder, still better than Highlander the Source.
By miles. I would willingly sit down in a chair and watch Mission Impossible again, whereas you'd have to tie me down, cut off my eyelids, and staple my lips shut so I couldn't scream through it to watch Highlander the Source again. Do you get the feeling we didn't like it?
We didn't like either of them, but Highlander the Source is... there's not enough pens to go negative.
I don't know. If we went to Staples right before their back-to-school sale and hit 3 Staples stores on the same day, there might be enough pens.
I'll give you a maybe on that.
In spite of how we might feel about the first Mission Impossible film, it obviously did well enough in the box office to warrant a sequel. 4 years later, in 2000, Mission Impossible 2 hit theaters, directed by John Woo.
That was like the big wow. John Woo directing a Mission Impossible film.
Now keep in mind that John Woo is the action director in Japan. You want an action movie, you want to guarantee it's going to be a blockbuster in Japan, you get John Woo. He is that big of a name over there.
He's James Cameron!
You had to invoke the name of James Cameron. You couldn't have referred to him as Japan's Michael Bay. Because if you'd called him Japan's Michael Bay, then I could have said, yeah, but John Woo has talent. But no, you had to go and use James Cameron, who I actually have some respect for.
So not only is John Woo a big name, he's actually somebody that both Jim and I respect highly.
Which is what made Mission Impossible 2 all the more painful to me.
Jim and I don't differ on movies often, but when we do, we tend to be at polar opposites. I loved Mission Impossible 2. I had a great time. I loved the classic John Woo Mexican standoff where Ethan and the bad guy are pointing the guns at one another.
Honestly, this movie came across to me as John Woo getting Americanized and given way too big of a budget. He could have done such a better movie on such a lower budget for me. The storyline was Ethan Hunt goes after a dirty IMF agent again.
In my mind, this was disavowing Mission Impossible, because they had Anthony Hopkins playing the older gentleman running Ethan Hunt, and I took it as them saying, this is actually Jim Phelps. We're ignoring the other movie.
Without actually saying, this is Jim Phelps and we're ignoring the other movie. I wish I could have better feelings for this movie. Maybe now that it's a decade later, maybe I need to go back and watch it again just to see if I can like it any better. There are movies out there that initial taste leaves a bad taste in your mouth, and from that point forward you go, ew, I don't want to taste that movie again, it left a bad taste in my mouth. Whereas a decade later, your tastes have changed some and you can appreciate different things, and maybe this is one of those movies that I need to go back and taste again. Again, it did well enough in the box office that they decided to make a Mission Impossible 3. It took them 6 years to do it, but they made a Mission Impossible 3.
This time it was directed by J.J. Abrams. Doug's fanboyness now makes me drool. This time Hunt goes after a global terrorist who has murdered an apprentice of his.
The apprentice was played by Kerry Russell, and as far as the J.J. Abrams thing goes, this is another one of those areas where we differ slightly. I tend to run hot or cold on J.J. Abrams, whereas if his name is attached to it, you're pretty much there.
Yeah, you got it.
I will say that for me, Mission Impossible 3 was the best of those movies so far. That being said, I still thought that it was too long, especially for an explosion fest. For an action movie that is boom, 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 more than 2 hours, it starts getting old for me. when it starts getting to that 2.5 hour, almost 3 hour mark, I needed some story in there. I need more than just things blowing up in my face to keep my attention.
You need more than car chases, gunfights, and explosions? You sad fool.
Yeah, silly me. I need a story. And this film did attempt to have a bit of story to it. It just kind of poured the story in to hold all the explosions, gunfights, and car chases together. Throw in the oven for 50 minutes at 350 degrees, and you have yourself a movie. Now, one of those things that I've noticed is that you actually have some fairly lengthy periods of time in between some of these movies. You've got 1996 to 2000, that's a 4 year gap. 2000 to 2006, that's a 6 year gap. 2006 to 2011, another 5 year gap. These aren't franchise movies where they're trying to crank them out as quickly and often as they can. There's actual time gaps in there. Probably a lot of that has to do with the fact that Tom Cruise is a big name actor, and he has a lot of stuff that he does. But it almost has that feel of, okay, have they had enough time to forget about the last Mission Impossible movie so that we can release the new Mission Impossible movie?
Have they had enough time to forget about Night and Day so we can release the new Mission Impossible movie?
I wish I could say that at least Cameron Diaz was decent in that movie, but that would be a lie.
Okay, the movie had gunfights, car chases, and explosions. I liked it. I don't think it's a good movie. I wouldn't recommend it, but I liked it.
Yeah. If you're brand new to TwerpCast, just because Doug says that he likes something doesn't make it good, even in his eyes. He likes bad stuff. Give him a good B-movie, good being a relative term, and he's a happy man.
You don't have to make good movies to make them entertaining. As you said, 5 years goes by, and we've got Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, written and directed by Brad Bird, who I wouldn't put him in my J.J. Abrams class, but he wrote and directed Iron Giant, Incredibles, Ratatouille.
Yeah, I like Brad Bird's The Incredibles. And the idea that he has done a superhero animated film does not make me automatically sit there and go, he's a bad choice for Mission Impossible. In a lot of ways, Mission Impossible, just like James Bond, is kind of a superhero story in and of itself. In this case, you've got a team of specialized experts who are going on out and fighting crime. Throw capes and cowls on them, and you've got the Bat Family. And I'm sorry, I just realized that I compared Tom Cruise to Batman, and God, that's not fair to Batman.
Batman had his ward, Dick Grayson.
Yeah, and I still think that Robin at the age of 13 was taller than Tom Cruise. I like the idea of Brad Bird as a director. I'm a little worried about the fact that this is his first live-action film. There are some very significant differences between directing an animated feature and a live-action feature.
I think as far as Geek Boys goes, there's a lot of geekiness to this movie. It's got Jeremy Renner in it, who starred in The Hurt Locker, but is also Hawkeye in The Avengers, and Simon Pegg of just about every nerdy thing on Earth.
Yeah, this movie has three things going for it that the previous ones didn't. The first being Brad Bird, the second being Simon Pegg, and the third being that from what I've seen of the trailers, and that's the only way that I can judge this, this movie has the international feel that, in spite of the fact that the others had an international background to them as well, I didn't feel the international background. I felt like it could have been taking place anywhere. The basis for this one is that the Kremlin is attacked, the Impossible Missions Force gets blamed for it, they get disbanded, and Ethan Hunt puts together a team of the few IMF members who haven't been arrested to try to find out what happened and clear their name. I'm just hoping it wasn't another IMF agent who has gone rogue. So, for the most part, I'm fully willing to give this movie a fair shot. I plan on seeing it that first weekend when it gets released, December 21st. We'll see if I'm pleasantly surprised or sorrowfully disappointed again.
As always, we thank you for listening to TwerpCast. We encourage your feedback. Please write Jim at twerponline.net. We can be found at Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, and Zanga.
TwerpCast has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2011.
This recording will self-destruct in 10 seconds.